Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Celia Rivenberg.
Thank y'all so much. Can you hear me okay? I have lost my southern accent. I don't know where it went. Y'all, if I seem a little rattled, it is because my Thurber friends, my brand new Thurber friends, will tell you. Thurber House, y'all, you just don't, I mean, well, of course you know, you're here, but it's wonderful, and I'm just so honored to be here, and I've spent the past couple of hours at the house relaxing to a point. I did not know there was such a crack security system, and so I foolishly did go downstairs, activated the kind of stuff like you saw in Mission Impossible with the lasers and whatnot, and this voice came booming out for several minutes saying, halt, freeze, police are on the way, and in fact, police were on the way. The girls had gone to dinner, and I had just thought I needed some downtime. Been kind of a long day. Got stuck in Atlanta. Lots of bad weather, blah, blah, blah. And so this cute little cop showed up, and he was so young he had puppy breath. He was just precious and darling, and he was not, he had his gun out of his holster, you know, the whole thing, like on TV, and I was like flapping, because Southern women always flap when we get nervous. So I was shaking and flapping. He had his gun drawn, and I pulled the curtains out because I couldn't open the door, and he was like, what? So, you know, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm trying to get dressed. And then we became friends, and he was just adorable, and I just wanted to say the house is lovely. I'm so honored to be here. When I looked at the pictures on the walls of all the authors who have visited Thurber House, it's unbelievable. I mean, really, I'm not kidding you. It's overwhelming is what it is, and I thank you so much for coming tonight. And, yes, y'all, I do write a newspaper column. I live in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I have written for newspapers since I was 18 years old. Skipped college. Not proud of that. That's just the way it worked out. You'll probably be able to tell by the But anyway, so I've always loved newspapers. I've always written a newspaper column for a long, long time about the events of the day. And yesterday I felt moved to write this one, which will appear next week. And it is political in nature. Being from North Carolina my whole entire life, I was represented by Senator John Edwards, whom I had an enormous crush on. And so the worm has turned, y'all. Not happy with him anymore. And I have the luxury of being able to vent, you know, when I'm put out by something. So I want to share with you what I just wrote. And I think it will be very healing for me. I don't know about y'all. But, okay, here goes. An attractive single woman friend of mine quipped over a glass of wine the other night that she was upset about John Edwards' cheating heart for two reasons. On the one hand, it's horribly disappointing that he's that kind of man, she said. But on the other hand, I'm upset because all this time I didn't know he was available. She is trash, isn't she? But it was kind of funny, you know. Such is our love-hate, really hate, because of what he did to our Elizabeth relationship with John Edwards, my former U.S. senator, whose boyish good looks and earnest anti-poverty speeches were as refreshingly intoxicating as a limoncello mojito, which they drink a lot of in Beverly Hills, where John Edwards visits his mistress and their love baby, if the National Enquirer can be believed, which it can. Face it, mainstream media, y'all blew it. You snoozed and lost. And now we realize that the political scandal of the year, if not the decade, was broken by the same supermarket tabloid that shares the news this week, swear to God, that Barack Obama's stepmother yearns to communicate with the ghost of Elvis. And, doing the math here, that exercise-addicted Kelly Ripa now officially weighs less than my left thigh. She is such a little bitch. Time was, I would not have believed anything in the Enquirer. Sure, it was fun to read. Who can honestly resist a good story about a child who is born half boy and half bat? No one, that's who. But exposing my former favorite mill worker's son as a womanizer bedding a rather horse-faced hoochie, while while his wife battled cancer has changed all that. Now I am, to use poker parlance, all in with the National Enquirer. Sure, they pay their sources, and their sources are often anonymous, and perhaps spend their days walking behind stolen shopping carts and believing that they're Elvis. But even a blind squirrel finds a nut now and again. This time, the nut was Edwards, who must still be pulling out the very $400 hairdo that I defended to the point of exhaustion a mere year ago, and wondering how the heck his 44-year-old girlfriend ended up pregnant. I mean, I know how. It's just that, don't you imagine Edwards thought that was one thing he didn't have to worry about? She said she was 40. She looked like she was 48. So now the Enquirer says Edwards has dispatched Hoochie and Baby to a secret location via private jet. On whose dime is another question. Having donated, y'all, to Edwards' various campaigns over the years, I ate that to America's stuff up like it was a loaded baked potato at Outback. I want to make sure my money was not involved in this sordid business. Who will find out for sure? Who else? The newspaper with the ads for removing evil spirit curses in the back. I repeat, y'all, all in. Thank you. Thank you so much. I feel better already for having read it. And thank you for putting up with it. That's just the news from not Lake Wobegon. That's from Eastern North Carolina. This is the new book. This is Bellwether, and the subtitle is Mostly Sunny with a Chance of Scattered Hissy Fits. Bellwether is my fourth book. I can't believe that. And I've got a fifth one coming out next year. It's just like a little assembly line, you know. Actually, I don't know. That fifth one's slow going. Anyway, I want to. Usually, I have a little bit of a focus. One theme will dominate the book more than others. And in this particular case, we did renovate our kitchen in our 90-year-old house last year, and so I wrote a lot of things about that. And how many of you have been through a substantial renovation in a home? Bless your sweethearts. Y'all, that's almost all of you. I don't think I didn't take that in. That's amazing. A home older than 90 years, maybe? Oh, my goodness, you have paid your dues. Well, you will so understand what I'm talking about. So the very first thing I want to read to you from this book is chapter 1, I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. For weeks, we had told the real estate agent that we were just crazy about contemporary homes. Hubby and I drooled over the cheap, sleek Scandinavian crap in the IKEA catalog. I imagined wearing all black or all white outfits and hosting pristine dinner parties where everyone had a white plate with a single perfect olive on it and nothing else. Our guests would laugh in a throaty, cultured, contemporary way as they pondered the origin of this perfect olive. Modern, get it, Miss Real Estate Agent with the Lexus SUV? No colonials, no Tudors, not so much as a 50s ranch house. Not for us. We wanted the kind of cool cat minimalist style you don't see much in small southern towns unless it belongs to the snooty art professor at the local college and his life partner. We were not a gay couple, obviously, but we sure were house shopping like one. So my 40-something agent slipped on her Ferragamos, fussed with her helmet hair in the mirror, tugged on her imitation St. John knit suit, and set her mind to finding us, the Southern freaks, the modern house of our dreams. She did a tremendous job, except for the time she apparently drank too much Robitussin and drove us to a split-level Brady Bunch house that made us gag and whine. This ain't contemporary at all, I chided her. One day, deep into the fourth month of house hunting, she drove us to a new development of contemporaries, and we oohed and awed over the white walls and the steely solemnity. The living room in the model home was straight off the cover of the Crate and Barrel catalog. You know, the one white couch, black fuzzy pillows, and that single perfect hot pink zinnia providing the only color in the room. It is so tasteful, it makes me want to throw up. Well, real estate lady said, sweeping her arms grandly, what do you think? Is this the one? It is, isn't it? I just know it is. Well, sort of, hubby said. Not so much, I said. Real estate lady tried mightily not to show the disappointment she was feeling. She had given us her best shot for 4 months, and it was not good enough. The next week, hubby and I got lost on a one-way street in an old section of town, and there on the street that no one knew about was the perfect house with a sign in the yard. We called real estate lady and asked her to find out all she could about it. She was so excited that she drove over immediately to the perfect house. But when she pulled up, her face was ashen. "You okay?" I asked. "But this isn't even close to contemporary." "Oh, yeah, about that," I said. We stood on the sidewalk in front of the perfect house and realized there was nothing like we described. Instead, it was a two-story federal style that was 90 years old and needed a ton of work. "Uh-huh, real estate managed. It's beautiful, but it's old, really old, and it looks like it might need a lot of work." "Don't worry," hubby crowed. "I can do a lot of the work myself." "Well, not really." Hubby is not what you would call handy. The one time I asked him to hang a picture in our apartment, it took 12 hours and a six-pack. And even then, that picture was crooked until the day we moved out. But you know how it is when you have house fever, and it's all we could think about was moving in that house. There would be an offer, a counteroffer, and tons of inspections. Looking back on it, I am fairly certain the inspector was on crack when he proclaimed that our house had good bones. Perhaps he simply meant that he'd run into some while underneath the house. Perhaps the brittle, calcified remnants of whatever handyman had been sucked into the murk for whatever repair long before we were born. With the purchase of this old house gone was the notion of the Olive dinner party. This was more redneck Riviera, a home for oyster roasts and third cousins passing out and sleeping in the yard. It was purely, deeply Southern, and we loved it. You could practically hear Olympia Dukakis imploring Sally Field to smack Shirley MacLaine across the face in the big backyard. Y'all know that scene I'm talking about? Oh, I love that scene so much. It was steel magnolias and yayas rolled into one, and looking at the two enormous pecan trees in the yard, I could not believe that I had ever thought we could go modern. This was our house, and we would love it and care for it and raise our baby in it and not even care when the basement flooded with 6 feet of water during hurricanes, which it did. Friends who visited our new old house always said the same thing. "Did y'all ever see that movie? Gosh, what was it called? Had Shelley Long in it. Maybe Michael Keaton, or was it Tom Hanks? Are you talking about The Money Pit?" And of course they were. "That's the one. This house reminds me of that house in the movie. Ha ha ha." We moved in and began the long process of renovation, at one point deciding it would be a whole lot easier to just check into the hospital and have repeated elective surgeries until it was safe to come home again. First up, the kitchen. When you've got a 90-year-old kitchen, you have to be prepared for the occasional unforeseen challenge, or as we like to call it, rot. "See," the contractor guy explained as though talking to two small, dim-witted children, "water is the enemy of wood." I was afraid he was going to say, "Now say it after me," just like my eighth-grade science teacher did. Water, it turns out, hates wood like Trump hates Rosie. The two spent entire decades fighting inside your walls. We had a crackerjack team working on our old house. There was, and I am not making these names up, Daryl and Damon and Donnie Ray and Dion. All, it's such a Southern thing, you know. And they weren't even related, but it's a D thing. So every morning the boys would roll up in assorted trucks, fumble for a cigarette or 10, and walk up and down looking at the rear of the house. They would always shake their heads, calling to mind the country expression I grew up with that applied to times when Aunt Elna J. or whomever had the cancer. In the rural South, the cancer surgery is always followed by a report from some kin proclaiming that they opened Elna J. up, but when they took a look inside, well, they just sewed her right back up. It's dramatic. It always is accompanied by stitching in the air motion. It never fails to elicit a chorus of "I swannies" or maybe a hushed "sweet Jesus" or two. This is how the D team looked at the kitchen and renovation. Even the prospect of a complete demo wasn't enough to cheer them up. It was a gargantuan task ahead, not made any easier by the first day's revelation that a very large dead rat would have to be dealt with when they pried up some boards. Daryl promptly threw up his barbecue sandwich and sun drop. And I realized that this was a sensitive bunch. I came to know the crew and the many sub-crews very well, and they in turn got to know me well. I adored these men and wished that I could have fed them biscuits and gravy every day, but since I no longer had any kitchen, that was pretty much impossible. After 3 months of male bonding, I had gotten used to the house crawling with men whose names began with D. Everything was going great, that is, until one very unfortunate morning. Please forgive the indelicacy that will follow. I thought they had all gone in their many trucks to the lumberyard to fetch wood to replace the particular challenge section of the day, alone at last and happily wandering in robe and slippers from room to room in my suddenly silent house. Let slip an ill wind, so to speak. It is not an exaggeration to say that it was so loud and resonant as to threaten the very newly poured foundation of my kitchen. Rebar, shmebar, something's going to blow. And then it happened on the other side of a thin piece of plywood that had been nailed up to protect the rest of the house from lung-clogging amounts of dust. I heard an embarrassed shuffling of feet and fake coughing. Precious Lord, take me now. And no, it matters not a whit that kings and queens do it. How could I have been so reckless? They always leave at least one man behind in case a new episode of Rot breaks out. I realize that this confession may startle those of you who assume that a southern flower such as myself would be incapable of committing such a vile act. But I can only be perfectly truthful with y'all and say that there is a first time for everything. I have known many men over the years who claim never to have heard their wives expel anything noisy from their bodies other than perhaps an excited and grateful squeal during lovemaking. But these men have no idea what happens when they finally clear out and women can at last behave as nature intended. People, we are human. As I stood frozen in horror and shame, I was filled with regret for the previous night's dinner. For just as water and wood are a really bad combination, so are a fish sandwich and cheddar pepper poppers from Sonic. I could not be sure, but I thought the D team was looking at me differently over the next few weeks. A few of them began to loudly burp as though to make me feel more comfortable in my own home. Their motives were pure and primal, I suppose. It's like in the wild when one animal does something to indicate to the other that they can be friends. It would have been inappropriate for us to sniff one another's naughties. So this was the best we could do under the circumstances. They need to understand that we're all human beings full of hopes and dreams and flatulence. One older gentleman who had read my confession in a newspaper column, because y'all, you know, I have no secrets, ventured out of his parlor and away from his Victrola long enough to inform me that he had been married 3 times and none of his wives had ever, and I'm quoting here from his email, committed such a despicable act. It did not exactly take the team from CSI Texarkana to figure out the cause of death of these old broads. They blew up. They blew up. After all, y'all, gas has to go somewhere. If you live with a, pardon me, old fart who is monitoring your every gas bubble, it's not going to be long before you explode. I'm just saying. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. There is just nothing like a little poot stuff to get things rolling. I would like to read one thing from, this is my second baby. This was We're Just Like You, Only Prettier, which is just a horrible thing to say, but funny. Come on, you know. So, this is a chapter. It's not very long that deals with the greatest generation. I have a fairly large extended family. Lots of my family tends to live well into their 90s, God bless them, which is, you know, great. But that... it results in a lot of jars of bacon grease. That's all I can tell you. Okay. So this is actually chapter 3 from We're Just Like You, Only Prettier. It's called There's a Hair in My Bacon Grease. The subtitle is Why the Greatest Generation is Rinsing Out Ziploc Bags and Eating Tomaine Turkey. I think Tom Brokaw said it best when describing the greatest generation. Why can't any of y'all throw out leftovers? Okay, maybe it was me, not Tom, who said that, but it's a question that comes to mind often, especially around the holidays when my 70 and 80-something friends lovingly scrape a single tablespoon of pearl onion casserole into a Tupperware container for later. Waste not, want, oh, I forget how it goes. Don't get me wrong, I adore my older friends. As I write this, my 81-year-old neighbor is on his roof cleaning out his gutters. I'm just praying that when he finishes, he'll offer to do mine. It's cold out. So, yes, I get the whole war surviving, depression, dealing with business, but what I don't get is why somebody who had a $35 monthly house payment and bought Circuit City stock for a quarter share is still cleaning and refolding used tinfoil and washing out Ziploc bags. My husband's aunt once salvaged a piece of mayonnaise speckled saran wrap I had tossed into the trash. She spent a good 5 minutes sponging it clean again and gave me a look that said I knew nothing of 10-mile walks to school uphill both ways with rickets. The greatest generation refuses to throw away disposable cups. Just watch them. Oh, I know. We young folks are squandering our natural resources. Truly, great majestic forests of solo party cup producing red, yellow, and blue plastic are disappearing faster than pierceable body parts. For some time now, I've realized that the greatest generation also has the greatest gastrointestinal tract. How else do you explain how a very senior citizen can eat and enjoy a 3-week-old piece of pork roast with no ill effects? While it would send a younger person straight to the emergency room and a close call with the white light. My friend knows better than to eat her grandmother's food. The woman has been known to thaw, cook, and refreeze a turkey until the poor bird finally just sits up on what's left of his freezer-burned haunches and screams to be put out of his misery. My friend Merlene's mama-in-law, like every southern woman of a certain age, even saves her bacon grease in a fancy little jar she made in ceramics that says drippings. Do y'all have those here? Yes, I'm hearing yeses and noes. Okay. And has hand-painted trolls dancing around under a mushroom tree. If you do have them, they're probably classier than that. As a newlywed, Merlene visited her mother-in-law and, being painfully eager to make a good impression, offered to clean up the kitchen. That's when her mother-in-law caught her pouring the bacon grease into an old mayonnaise jar and tossing it in the trash. What happened next was a blur, but Merlene said her mama-in-law's reaction was swift. From the sound of it, she could not have been more shocked or hurt if she had personally witnessed Merlene doing the devil's aerobics with the minister of music right there on her new congolium. She sprang like a cheetah across that kitchen, rescued the bacon grease, and holding it tender as a newborn, slowly poured the still warm contents back into the drippings jar. The greatest generation often sniffs conspiracy where there is none. At the KFC, my elderly friend narrowed her eyes when told there was no dark meat available at the moment. "You don't have any dark meat?" she asked, eyes narrowed and sizing up the gin wire in front of her. Her tone implied that there had been some sort of dark meat conspiracy, and the employees were in the back juggling thighs and drumsticks and joyfully spitting in the coleslaw. We left and moved on to McDonald's, where I was berated for forgetting to order her senior Coke. "I don't know why you don't just slow down and throw that 20 cents right out on the highway," she huffed. "And where is my senior fish sandwich?" "It's chicken," I said wearily. "They were all out of fish." "I'll just bet they were." Sometimes I'm aware that I'm turning into my grandma. I'm becoming one of them. Yesterday I screeched to my 10-year-old friend who had joined us for lunch that I would give him a quarter if he would take my kid to the gumball machine so I could complete the mind-imploding task of calculating a tip. The boy looked distressed while I once again screamed, "Where's my purse?" And yes, it was on my lap. And then he quietly informed me that I had given him a nickel. Oh, well, it's a dadgum dark in restaurants these days. I have also discovered as I age less than gracefully that I have zero patience. The other day, as I stood in the 20 items and under checkout at the new Slap Your Mama Fine Super Walmart, I grew increasingly irritated. It's supposed to be faster, but it isn't because it allows all kind of credit and debit swiping and swooshing and Espanol and whatnot. No one actually pays with cash money anymore like when I was a girl. I know this because I gave the cashier a $20 bill and she looked at it puzzled like it was badly aged lettuce. Before that, I had tried 3 lines that apparently turned out to be not moving at all. They were apparently faux checkouts. Walmart seems to have more of these than anybody else. People who look like real customers stand for hours at a time talking with people who look like real cashiers, but no one ever moves. Sometimes you will stand in line forever, and this one goober will come to, you know the one, y'all, I know you know this. He will come to the end of a long line, then jump in front when a new register is open. You've seen this, haven't you? I had a fight with a line jumper, having invested 15 minutes in a non-moving line. A new register opened, and he walked right up. I ran over, dropped to all fours, and started gnawing on his pants leg, pulling him slowly away from the register. "You're a nut," he said, backing away. "Fair's fair," I mumbled. Recently, I had the misfortune to get behind a giggly, cute young couple who, oopsie, had selected the only frozen turkey at Walmart that had neither weight nor price on it. I waited and watched my nails grow until the perky girlfriend arrived triumphant with the newly weighed turkey. I scowled and considered wearing my bedroom shoes to the store next time because they're so much more comfortable. Later on, cute couple blocked my car with their cart while they took turns hopping on the back of it and pretending to steer one another on a sled. It was so cute, so joyous, so young and in love. It really pissed me off. "Hey, Mork and Mindy," I call. "Get a room." I have become the Hallmark crone, and I like it. Can washing the chinette really be far behind? Thank you so much. Thank you. I want to read to you something. This is a book. Now, I did not write this book. I did contribute to it. This is Southern Fried Farce, and if y'all ever have occasion to see it, it came out last year, and I don't think there was a tour associated with it, but you do see it every now and then. It's got some really good stuff in it, wonderful tales that really are written by Southerners, but, you know, a lot of wisdom in general. And I enjoyed so much being asked to contribute to this anthology because it's the first time that I've been able to write about really my childhood and my past, you know, in a very personal way. And I really hope you enjoy this piece. And then probably depending on how long it is, we'll see how it goes. This is called The Wrestler and the Fan. I remember just like it was yesterday, the sticky July morning, I stole the wrestling poster off the telephone pole and made little Hermie Drucker cry. Sure, I was 12 and I should have taken the high road. Hermie, the asthmatic red-headed kid brother of a friend of mine, was only 7, and the wail he let out when he pedaled his Western Auto banana bike up to that pole to claim his poster could have been heard 6 counties away. I could easily hear Hermie's screams of outrage from my post across the road at Macmillan's, a rickety country store with a wood floor so worn out that to a bare foot it felt as soft as a satin bedspread. Watching Hermie from underneath the rusty overhang at the Sinclair pumps made me feel a little guilty. There he was, so full of hope and determination, ready to rip our poster off that telephone pole and skedaddle back home, where he would have no doubt taped it to his wall right alongside the Rip Hawkins Sweet Hansen poster he'd stolen from me not 6 months earlier. Just thinking about it made me mad as a hen on a hot griddle. Little shit, I thought to myself, picturing the way the green and orange and yellow striped poster with photos would have looked on my own bedroom wall. Hermie and I both wanted this latest poster, and we finally agreed, me with my fingers crossed neatly behind my back, that the only Christian thing to do would be to wait until the tag team match between George Becker and Johnny Weaver at the Wallace National Guard Armory was officially over, which had been last night. "You snooze, you lose," I shouted to Hermie, who just stared at me as if I had sprouted horns and a forked tail. All that was left on the creosote pole were little bitty pieces of the orange corners of the poster stuck to the staples that I had not been able to dislodge. They mocked him. Although he was only 7 years old, Hermie's apple had not fallen far from the evangelistic family tree. His grandmother, a snow-haired woman of 4 feet 8 inches in height and the same approximate width, had taught the catechism to all the country kids in our dinky little Carolina town. "You're going to hell," Hermie said, now wiping away the beginnings of a tear. As he stomped his flip-flop foot pointlessly into a growth of pop gums, I watched with increasing amusement, finally catching his eye just long enough to flip him off. "Hell, hell, that just seals the deal," Hermie hollered. I'd have to do a good deal of catechism refreshment for loving Hermie's misery so much. "We had a deal," he yelled with a fierceness I was not altogether expecting. Hanging at his sides, Hermie's fat little fists were balled up so tight it made the freckles disappear right off his knuckles. I cupped my hand behind my ear and shook my head. "I can't hear a word out of your freckly-lipped mouth," I was letting him know, which obviously wasn't the truth. "What's up Hermie's butt?" my friend Deb asked, having maneuvered her bike under the overhang beside mine. "I got the poster first," I said. "Ooh, don't look like he's taking it too good," she said, causing us both to laugh because now Hermie had taken to jumping up and down on the pop gums like a damn fool. "It's mighty hot out, Hermie," I hollered. Deb ripped open a skinny little sleeve of Lance's salted peanuts, and just as we'd done a million times before, poured half the contents of the bag into her Coca-Cola and handed me the rest. We switched off and shared like that, first me buying the peanuts and then Deb. This was a concept Hermie was going to have to learn the hard way. "Shut up," he said, continuing to stomp and getting red-faced and redder in the face. I wasn't sure if seven-year-olds could actually have a stroke, but Hermie looked like he might be headed that way. "Both of y'all need to grow up," said Deb, wiping some stray peanut salt off her cheeks with the back of her hand. "It's just a stupid wrestling match. Who cares, anyway?" "Who cares?" Deb, dressed in a roughly midriff shirt and madras shorts she'd bought with money from Prime and Tobacco, had no time for such pursuits. At 14, she was far more interested in finding a boyfriend with a car who she could go riding around with on Friday night. This is what passed for entertainment back in rural eastern North Carolina in the 60s and 70s, and may still, for what I know. Maybe wrestling was something I would grow out of, but I doubted it. My idea of a good time had nothing to do with getting in some fool's car and riding around the Dario something like 700 times in a row, while Steppenwolf howled from the 8-track. No, when I was 12, a good time was defined by eating an entire box of Crackin' Good butter cookies, always on sale at Winn-Dixie for 59 cents a box, while watching the wrestling matches on TV every Saturday night. It should be noted that no one in my family shared my passion for wrestling. In fact, the only person in my immediate world who understood how I felt about wrestling was, at this very minute, seated on a tuffet made of stomped pop gums, crying his little heart out. Looking at that broken little boy, I felt like a monster. A monster with the coolest damn poster of all. Because I loved George Becker and Johnny Weaver better than all the other professional wrestlers put together. There had been brief flirtations with others, but George and Johnny were my favorites, and nothing would ever change that. I was not alone in my obsession. How else could they raise so many thousands of dollars from truly poor people who would stand in line for more than an hour to sit in the sweaty, smelly armory? Usually it was a fundraiser with a smallish percentage going to the volunteer fire department to buy Jaws of Life or maybe the Ruritans Building Fund. So you could even say that it was noble to attend these events. Not so noble, perhaps, to shotgun beers out in the parking lot ahead of time like some of the kids did, but nothing's perfect. I was not old enough to go to a wrestling match at the armory by myself, so I had to settle for watching my heroes on TV. When that nasty little Japanese wrestler, I forget his name on purpose, took out a drawstring bag of salt hidden in the waistband of his shorts and tossed the contents into George and Johnny's eyeballs, I jumped up from my chair, scattering flower-shaped butter cookies all over the oval braided rug on our living room floor. "Y'all know he's sneaky," I chopped, talking to the TV, just as if my boys could hear me and correct their behavior. "Educated people do not watch this sort of thing," my mother huffed as she walked by and scowled at the cookies on the rug. "You do know it's all fake, don't you?" I had an answer for that awful question right ready. If it's fake, then why does Dr. Dawes believe in enough to buy out 50 front row seats every single time the wrestling comes to the armory? My mother shook her head. She did not have an answer for that, and frankly, no one else did either. Dr. Dawes was as close as you could get to a real-life saint walking and living amongst us. He healed people and saved lives and birthed so many thousands of babies, me included, that he was even written up as Tar Heel of the Week in the News Observer. "You think the Tar Heel of the Week wouldn't know if something was fake or not?" I asked, sensing that I had found the perfect vulnerable spot. My mother shrugged sadly and left the room, unable to offer any sort of rational explanation for this man she loved and respected being caught up in something so obviously moronic. But there sat Dr. Dawes at ringside. I saw it with my own eyes one night when I was in my 20s, the same scrupulously clean and oddly elegant hands that had caught thousands of babies and comforted thousands more sick souls, clenched into fists, balled up just like little Hermie Drucker's on that long-ago day. At age 75 or so, Dr. Dawes shouted, slung popcorn, and all but crawled into the ring himself to right a perceived wrong. "Settle down now, Doc," the referee said, trying unsuccessfully not to grin. No doubt Dr. Dawes had delivered the referee into the world along with anyone else under the age of 50 that happened to be in the audience. In the newspaper, it had been noted that Dr. Dawes had even delivered three sets of Siamese twins. This was, of course, before political correctness would water that down to the clinical conjoined twins that is used today. Face it, when the bad guy wrestler in the ring with an Asian heritage is nicknamed the Yeller Menace, it is fairly obvious that no one frets much about racial stereotypes. The stereotypes were in glorious form in the wrestling ring. Maybe that was the appeal of the whole thing to someone like me who liked everything simple and orderly. The good guys looked good, the bad guys wore hideous tight masks over their faces and scowled and spat. Good looks helped. Over the years, I switched my shallow loyalties to a wrestler named Mike Rotundo, who I once drove 100 miles to see in person at somebody else's crappy National Guard armory. Years later, long after Little Hermie Drucker had become a highway patrolman, much respected by all the community, and I had become a newspaper reporter, not respected by much of anybody, I had the chance to go to a wrestling match again. I had volunteered to do a profile on the state of rural wrestling fundraisers, arguing that they were practically non-existent thanks to cable. I had done something similar on womanless weddings and on people who make clothes out of beer cans and a whole bunch of other southern oddities. Maybe nobody goes anymore because they finally figured out it's all fake, said one snooty reporter who had moved south from Connecticut. It's not like it's a real sport. He put little quote marks in the air when he got to the word sport. I chuckled at the image of what this annoying ass Yankee boy would look like after a few seconds in the ring with my old crush Mike Rotundo. Stewed squash, that's what. Showing up with pad and pen, I was going to do something else that I was doing a lot lately, much to the delight of all the newcomers, and that was to tell them about the way it used to be. Stepping into a pitiful gym with peeling paint 38 miles from the nearest Starbucks, I watched a young local make his debut in the ring. He called himself Mean Mike Brash. Trouble was, he wasn't mean at all, just a very young, pale, and rather slightly built, blonde-headed boy who thought high school was overrated and was chasing his dream right off the TV screen and into this dilapidated gym. It was for a good cause, as usual. In this case, charity began and ended at home. Proceeds would help buy paint for the gym. Thank goodness his tag team partner, the Dark Knight, was more savvy. He played to the crowd, pretending to throw a chair at a little girl who screamed and hid behind her 18-year-old daddy's skinny legs. Once the match started, with the good guys wearing red, white, and blue, and Mean Mike calling a little bent-over country woman who was booing him from the front row, "You toothless old hag," I felt right at home. It had been too long. I forgot about taking notes, savoring the spectacle in front of me, and burning my throat with two salty popcorn. The little woman balled up her fist in front of her face, just like Dr. Dawes had done so many years ago, and to the amazement of everyone in the gym except her grown son beside her, invited Dark Knight to come down here and say that, you bastard. Fake? Real? It mattered not. This was Southern-style wrestling at its essence, and I, for one, knew that the only thing that would make this night more perfect would be a box of butter cookies to eat, or perhaps toss into the ring in disgust. I heard that Mean Mike's career ended shortly after that night, having had to choose between snapping necks and saving souls. He became a gospel singer with a band that played in the very same armories where he'd once called nice people's grandmas toothless old hags. Only in the South, I thought. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. I know that was a little bit long, but it just kind of, I don't know. What can I tell y'all? It's just, I have an obsession. I'm going to read, I have time to read one more little one from the new book. And this is called It's No Secret How TV God Ruined My Life. I do write kind of a variety of things. I do the Southern stuff, but I do an awful lot of pop culture stuff, and so I hope you enjoy this. Huns, it's a sad moment when you realize that your true calling, the reason you were put here on God's green earth, will always elude you. I refer, of course, to my dream of being the person who writes the program descriptions for TV Guide. The dream died in the year of our Lord, 2006, when my beloved periodical, that which hath served as coaster to many a sweaty glass of iced tea, protected my mama's mahogany drum table for the better part of four decades, abruptly changed formats. Oh, vile corporate America, which takest away my dream, and paradoxically giveth me a strange urge to write in some kind of faux Bible speak. Enough of that, y'all. I just want to up and cry. No matter where my writing jobs led, I always felt that the Holy Grail would be to write the program synopses for TV Guide. It wasn't my fallback. It was my dream job, and now, verily, it will never be. As a small and admittedly weird child, I whiled away numerous hours scribbling possible program descriptions for imaginary episodes of my favorite TV series. For Gunsmoke, a mysterious stranger threatens to disrupt the annual calf rope festival in Dodge City. For Friends, hilarity ensues when Ross and Joey switch identities for a day. For Lost, the freakish tropical polar bear devours all the island inhabitants except a whiny blonde who is deemed too scrawny to mess with. I pictured being paid a pile of money to watch hundreds of hours of TV before reducing a complicated plot line to a few powerful nouns and verbs. I practice by comparing my work with the ones in the real TV guide, and usually I like mine better. Some people are blessed with the ability to cure disease or invent life-saving technology for people in third world countries. I am blessed to be able to succinctly convey the perfect distillation of pathos and humor in any given episode of The Sweet Life of Zach and Cody. Sadly, as we all now know, my gift will never be used because of the format change, which makes TV Guide just another idiot periodical that I positively cannot put down. In making the change, the publishers announced that TV listings would shrink 75%, leaving more room for stories about stars, trends, reviews, and other stuff we could get a gazillion other places. And what's with the new inferior TV Guide's obsession with American Idol? It will probably shock y'all to read this, but I have never watched a single episode of American Idol. Not one. Never, ever. Is there help for people like me? People who do not know but only hear snippets about a nasty Brit named Simon? Or rumors of loopy behavior by Paula Abdul? And what, pray tell, is a Ryan Seacrest? The truth is, I need TV Guide just to be able to function in polite society and pretend to be an idolater. Everyone I know, and I mean everyone, even the old man who smokes through a hole in his throat at the produce stand, is for real, y'all. Is obsessed with AI. I'm like, are these peppers really three for a dollar? And he's like, growly, as always, Kelly Pickler got robbed last night. And I'm like, who? And he's like, you can't shop here no more. At least I think that's what he's saying. Perhaps I can't relate to Idol because I'm such a crappy singer myself, although, and I do not like to brag, absolutely no one can touch my steamed-up shower version of Billie Holiday's Good Morning Heartache. It is idelicious. As self-appointed pop culture high priestess, I do need TV Guide to speak intelligently when Mandisa's voted off the island or whatever the idolaters do, but that doesn't mean I like the new format. The revamped TV Guide looks so well ordinary. Jerry Seinfeld once observed that no one ever handed anyone a TV Guide. The compact little magazine was always thrown. Was there any other magazine you can think of that could sail across a den so magnificently? I thought not. TV Guide was for five decades incredibly and undeniably aerodynamic. Now we are forced to throw Reader's Digest across the room, but it's just not the same. I have tried it, and yes, I do realize how pathetic that sounds. So who really killed TV Guide? As nutty as it sounds, the magazine did itself in when it provided on-screen program guides for cable companies. Predictably, quality has suffered. For 2 weeks in a row recently, I was subjected to this electronic program guide description of my beloved Days of Our Lives. Relationships grow and die in the fictional town of Salem. That's it. Are you kidding me? What about something a little more worthy of the very name TV Guide? Let's see if I've still got the gift. Ah, yes. How about a frantic Samantha fears her fiancé Lucas will call off their wedding when he realizes she was once a man. Now, you watch that show. It's selfish to whine about losing my dream job when so many of the big names in television are suffering just as much. Poor Dan Rather quit CBS in a huff after the network dissed him by essentially giving the award-winning anchor and watery-eyed veteran of innumerable national calamities an office the size of a Cheez-It with instructions not to use the phone for personal calls. TV can be a cruel medium. Look at the rise and fall of Star Jones, one-time humble McDonald's fry girl turned brilliant court reporter turned voracious man-eating, weight-losing, fur-wearing bridezilla. Barbara Walters, 105, said that she was just sick about Star's sudden exit from The View because she and co-host Elizabeth Hasselbeck and Joy Behar had been planning all along to simply feed the suddenly diminutive Star to View add-on Rosie O'Donnell during Sweeps Month. The timing sucked on this one, said Babs. When watching The View, which I periodically do if dragged into a room and my eyelids are glued open a la A Clockwork Orange, I want to feel like I'm with my posse, my gal pals, sipping margaritas and bitching about our men. I'm ashamed to say, but I like Star better fat. She bought her shoes at Payless, for heaven's sakes. How much more real and girlfriendy can you get? But Star got skinny and greedy and committed the ultimate tacky foul by asking sponsors to pay for her wedding in exchange for a few ham-handed mentions on the show. Celebrities are terrific at mending battered images, and all Star has to do is go on Oprah's show and apologize for unmitigated tackiness. If that does not work, she can always immediately adopt at least one baby from a war-ravaged country or simply borrow one from the perpetually pregnant Heidi Klum. And speaking of Oprah, y'all, I am officially over her. Over the years, I have sent copies of all my books to Miss Thing, and I have never heard P. Turkey squat back. Now, don't get me wrong. I did not honestly expect to hear anything from O, but I was, as she is so fond of saying, putting it out there in the universe. Sadly, my universe apparently ends at O's mailroom. And I suspect those books never made it upstairs to the Harpo offices, much less to the rarefied jasmine-scented air of O's personal workspace, which I imagined to look a lot like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, with lots of tiny little Oprah helpers scurrying about and doing her bidding. I never even got the pre-stamped autographed picture of O advising me to live your best life or similar drivel. That said, it was with no small amount of skepticism that I watched O's recent show on The Secret. I practiced writing a TV guide synopsis in my head just for old time's sake, but it came out sounding bitter. Oprah reveals the secret to the perfect life based on the rants of author Rhonda Byrne and a panel consisting of a former drug dealer, a recovering slut, and the guy who writes the chicken soup books. Oprah's panel of geniuses agreed that you can get anything you want in life by simply thinking, feeling, and acting positive. Shit, all I'd done was use correct postage. No wonder she never responded to my books. Watching the panel of secret experts, I realized that my negative energy had ensured that Oprah would never read my books. My dismal failure to attract O was my own fault. I had turned Oprah into Nopra. How? Well, that's easy. Hadn't I said to the woman at the post office, here goes nothing, and great, another 547 down the frickin' drain, when I mailed them to Chicago. According to The Secret, I should have said to the postal clerk, this book is going to be delivered personally to Ms. Oprah Winfrey's hands, and she is going to read it and love it and endorse it, and soon I will be able to hire a personal assistant, and I will not have to stand here and wait in this line full of losers, loser assholes, and watch the hair... And watch the hair on my legs get longer. Okay, I'm sorry. That whole positive energy thing really isn't working for me. And because everybody listens to Oprah and has run out, purchased, and is now living by The Secret, the postal clerk will smile lovingly at me and say, you are absolutely right. Oprah is going to love this book, and you are going to have a great life, and I am too, because now that I have The Secret, I no longer daydream about plunging an oyster knife into my husband's ears while he sleeps. Well, alrighty then. Bottom line, I'm resubmitting my books to Oprah and happily visualizing them flying off the shelves because, as the former drug dealer, or maybe it was ex-whore, said, like attracts like. I'm also taking the wisdom of The Secret to heart and reminding myself out loud every day that I am phenomenal. And because I had put all these positive thoughts into the universe, I had become a human vessel filled with gratitude and forgiveness, who is going to be really pissed if this crap doesn't work. Dang, there I go again with the negative stuff. My friend and Sunday school teacher, yeah, y'all can't believe I go to Sunday school, do you? Beth says that whenever she has a negative thought, she just snaps a rubber band that she wears on her wrist to remind her to shake off the bad thoughts and be more positive. If I am being honest, Beth's solution, which costs less than a penny a week, seems like a much more economical solution than buying The Secret book accompanying 90-minute DVD and signing up for The Secret seminars at the local Ramada. Watching Oprah carry on about The Secret during two entire episodes made me want to shake her or remind her that she's from Mississippi. Maybe she's been living in Chicago too long. In the South, we are innately skeptical of this sort of drivel. We're still smarting from buying all those lightning rods that still sit on top of our houses, not to mention those anointed prayer cloths that the TV preacher swore would make our bunions go away. In the immortal words of George W. Bush, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on you again. No, that's not right. Fool me twice, oh, what the hell? We will not get fooled again. We're over it. We know life is not simple. We have the bunions and burned out home place to prove it. To buy into The Secret is admitting that I believe that all I got to do to get dinner on the table is to put out there in the universe I'd like some meatloaf, snap beans, and fresh corn to materialize onto my family's plates long around 6 p.m. like we're the damn Jetsons. It's not going to happen. To hear Secret head cheerleader and author Rhonda Byrne tell it all we have to do to get anything we want, weight loss, perfect health, fame, fortune, early 90s Dennis Quaid when he looked really hot, is to become that which you want on the inside and you shall receive it in the outside world. My big ass. Speaking of which, why don't I just secret my way to trading in my lumpy carcass for the perky posterior of a 20-year-old aerobics instructor? I'm putting it out there in the universe. Unfortunately, it's going to be fighting with the heartfelt wish for a pan of homemade peach cobbler that I also just put out there. Yes, huns, that's right. It's a perky ass versus peach cobbler smackdown. Then why should we choose? I can have it as long as I ask and believe I will receive, says Byrne. Besides, Byrne says overweight people get that way from thinking fat thoughts. That's precisely the sort of noodle brain logic I expect from a woman who looks like she weighs 90 pounds soaking wet. No sugar, they get that way from eating mac and cheese at the Cracker Barrel 5 times a week and twice on Sunday. Even though the secret smacks of hooey and hokum to most God-fearing Southerners, I'm sure there are a few who are thinking it's worth a try if it helps them get a husband with a trust fund or a boat slip in the best marina. Even my best redneck friend Dempsey said he's using the secret to get a new bass boat. Face it, y'all, when rednecks embrace the secret, that tells me that it's done gone mainstream. I just sit around and picture me sitting in that bass boat, says Dempsey, whose wife Loretta turned him on to changing the universe with his mind after seeing Oprah on the TV at the laundromat one fateful afternoon. Loretta admitted that changing the universe with his mind might be ambitious for someone who has trouble remembering to change his underwear. But she is proud of all the positive magnetism her husband is projecting. My Dempsey is just eat up with positivity, she told me one day. Because a big part of the secret is being prepared for the inevitable granting of wishes and goals, Dempsey has laid in a stock of PBRs and Slim Jim beef jerky sticks to take out on the boat when it does arrive. You have to be ready for the fulfillment of your magnetism, Dempsey said. The laws of attraction are all that governs our entire universe. What does that really mean, I asked him. Shit if I know, said Dempsey. And somewhere, Rhonda Byrne is laughing her bony ass off. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. What a wonderful, wonderful responsive audience. That makes me feel so good. I think we can do some questions and answers maybe if anybody.